Today we're talking with Jennifer Shannon, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She's the co-founder and clinical director of Santa Rosa Center for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy in Santa Rosa, California. And she's the author of The Shyness, a Social Anxiety Workbook for Teens. Today we're going to be talking about teen social anxiety disorder cognitive behavioral interventions that work. Thank you, Jennifer, for joining me. Let me ask you the first point, which is, what is social anxiety?
Well, there's a really good Peanuts strip that I love that I think says it all, and it's Charlie Brown is sitting, eating lunch alone, and he's talking about how lunchtime is the loneliest hour of the day. And he really wants to talk with that little redhead girl, but he knows that if he went up to her, that she'd never like him because he's so blah and stupid. And he thinks that if he did go up to her, everybody would probably laugh because someone as blah as he did even tried to talk with her. And that really captures social anxiety. And social anxiety is a fear of doing something embarrassing or looking foolish, of being judged, criticized, disapproved of, or rejected. And I see shyness and social anxiety disorder on a continuum, and that it's really a matter of how much is a teen avoiding things. And it becomes a disorder when the avoidance interferes with normal functioning, so things like going to school, academic performance, social anxiety, and relationships.
How common is social anxiety?
Social anxiety is the most common anxiety disorder, and it's the fourth most common mental health disorder. So, and shyness is even more common, so again, going back to the continuum, and an interesting survey of 1,000 people, 40% that said that they were shy to the point of it being a problem. And in terms of meeting criteria for social anxiety disorder, it's about 12 to 13% of the population. And that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people. And so how common is it among teens and young adults? Is there a higher percentage?
It's the same in the adult population and the adolescent population, so about 12 to 13%. And there's another thing that's interesting is there's no difference between males and females, so both sexes are equally at risk. Okay. The age of onset of social anxiety disorder is between 11 and 19, and it's actually quite rare for an adult to develop it, so it almost always does develop during adolescence.
So you can really consider it a childhood anxiety disorder.
You know, you really could, yes. Okay. And if you think about adolescence in terms of that developmental stage where it's really one of such self-consciousness anyway, mm-hmm. and the shift is from caring about what your parents think to caring about what your peers think about you, and so how you look, what you're wearing, if you have zits, a bad hair day, all of those things really matter, and they can feel like a matter of life and death.
Okay, so let me stop you for a minute, too, and just, we're going a little bit off, but I'm remembering, these many decades back, when you have those concerns, it doesn't mean you have social anxiety disorder. When does it actually become disordered?
Right, exactly, because so many adolescents do have those concerns. So it's really when it's about avoidance. If those concerns are, it's like, I have a bad hair day, I can't go to school today.
Okay.
Then now it's interfering with functioning. That's what makes it a disorder.
Okay, great. What causes social anxiety disorder?
Well, it's probably, lost my place here. It's probably, a lot of it is genetic. Probably 30 to 40% is genetic. And in fact, if you have a first degree relative with social anxiety, you're 3 to 4 times more likely to develop it. And other things can be parent modeling. So if you have a parent who's quite inhibited or doesn't have a lot of friends or is overly concerned with appearances, then that might, the modeling might affect you. And then there's things like little T or big T traumas. For example, I was working with an adolescent who, when he was younger in elementary school, had been teased for having big ears. And so he was called elephant ears, and he really feels that that influenced his development of social anxiety disorder later on. So,
So when people come for treatment, mm-hmm. what's the treatment that you recommend? What have you seen that works?
The two different types of treatment that have been found to be effective are cognitive behavioral therapy, which I'll be talking more about, and medication. And medication, for example, antidepressants like SSRIs, Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa, some of those medications, as well as specific anti-anxiety medications. But the thing is, if a teen's going to use be prescribed medication, the relapse rate's very high if you go off the medication. So you'd want to combine cognitive behavioral therapy with the medication.
Can you describe what a patient can expect when they come in for treatment?
Yeah, I can. I mean, cognitive behavioral therapy is based on the relationship between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. So if we take a typical situation, a teenager may be avoiding lunchtime because he's afraid of talking to people. So that's the behavior, the avoidance. But why is he doing that? Why is he avoiding? And it's because he's feeling nervous. Unstructured time makes him feel nervous. So now we can understand why he's avoiding. He's feeling nervous. But why is he feeling nervous? Because he's thinking that he might not know what to say, that there might be an awkward silence, that if he does say something, the other person may think it sounds stupid. So those are the thoughts that the teen with social anxiety might have. And the thoughts are important, and they're usually always overestimations of social threat. And they contain what we call cognitive distortions. So if we take part of that thought, if I say something, it will sound stupid, that's called mind reading. You're assuming that the other person is thinking something negative about you. And in cognitive behavioral therapy, we help the teen to notice what they're thinking and label some of those distortions in the thought. So that's the C part of cognitive behavioral therapy. And then the B part is we've got the behavior. He's avoiding breaks at school because he's worried about what would happen if someone talked to him or if he talked to someone. And it's true that by avoiding lunch breaks, he's managing his anxiety that way. But he doesn't get to test if his thoughts are accurate or not. And he doesn't get to practice small talk. So there's no new learning going on. And so the avoidance may work in the short run, but it doesn't work in the long run. And of course, the opposite of avoidance is facing your fears, and we call this exposure therapy. But that's not done all at once. It's done in small, manageable steps, sort of like climbing a ladder. So for example, on the bottom of the ladder might be something like smiling and saying hi to somebody, then maybe going up to one person, asking them a question or sharing something about themselves. What they did last weekend. And then the top of the ladder might be actually asking someone to get together with them.
In your experience, what works effectively for teens and young adults, and are any treatments more effective than others? And is it up to an individual, or is that the factor as well? Each individual responds differently.
Yeah, there is a lot of variance. I mean, if the teen that comes in is usually motivated around the social aspect. And I realize we actually missed talking about the consequences of the disorder. Can I stick
yes,
that in and then
definitely.
Talk about,
let's talk
just
about
talk
that.
A little
yes.
bit about, because there are a lot of pretty serious consequences with this disorder. And of course, those consequences is what can help motivate the teen to do treatment. And so the consequences that I was starting to say that most motivate the teen have to do with the social relationships, if they don't have enough friends or they want to make more friends or do more things socially. And another aspect or consequence of this disorder is academic performance. So it is highly correlated with school absences and sometimes school refusal altogether. It can affect academic performance in not speaking up during discussions, fear of asking a stupid question. So if you don't know the academic material, you may not ask to get the clarification because you think it's a stupid question. And it can, you know, affect oral presentations, which actually most people have an anxiety about oral presentations. And there's a really good Seinfeld quote, and he says, most people would rather be dead than speak in public. And that means that at a funeral, the average person would rather be in the casket than doing the eulogy.
Yes.
So it's that one's a very common one, but most people will do it. A socially anxious teen may not. And the avoidance is correlated with depression because you're becoming so isolated. And so you get depressed, and it's also associated with substance abuse because a teen might be using substances to go into a social situation to manage their anxiety, alcohol in particular, because it's a disinhibitor. And there are higher rates of suicide amongst teens. That's probably correlated with the depression and substance abuse. So there are a lot of serious consequences to the disorder. And that can be motivating, going back to who responds well to treatment.
So you have to be motivated to get treatment, and so they take it from there, and
yes.
You help them walk through it.
And what we do at our center is we like to start people off, the teens off, in individual therapy, but then we try to move them to group. And the reason that we do that is because group provides more real-life exposures. You have other peers, and that's usually who they're mostly anxious around. Mm-hmm. So you have peers in the group. So one thing it does is it helps normalize that there's others like them that are suffering from this. And then you have a lot more access to some really great exposures and practice. And just to give a couple examples of some of the things that we do in our groups, we have small talk practice. So we have teens maybe get in dyads and practice small talk for a couple minutes. We have practice joining in a conversation. So we might have three teens talking and the fourth teen needs to come in and try to join that conversation, which is great practice. We have a game that we play where we throw a ball around, and when you catch the ball, you have to give an opinion of something, like it might be a favorite food or it might be a music group that you like. So group is scary, of course, because that's where their anxiety is, but that's also, it's really repeatedly facing and mastering your fears that's going to help you get past them.
What would you like to see happen in the near future in treating this disorder in teens?
Well, I have a personal story related to this, and my daughter, Rose, when she was in middle school, she started not wanting to go to school. She started telling me that she was actually hiding during lunch break. She was hiding in the bathroom. And it was really surprising because prior to that, she's very bright, she was very outgoing and very well-liked, so it seemed so irrational, but I did recognize very quickly that she was developing social anxiety disorder. And it's true that I specialize in anxiety treatment, but she's my daughter, she's a preteen, and so not super receptive to being her therapist, which makes sense. So I actually went to get her a book on social anxiety written for teens, and there wasn't anything out there, which was so surprising since that's the onset of social anxiety disorder. A lot written for adults, but not for teens. And that got me to write the social anxiety workbook for teens. And so what I would really like to see is that teens, as well as adults, realize that they're not alone, that there's a lot of other teens out there, that there are things that you can do to overcome this disorder. And I'd also really love to see more therapists trained in cognitive behavioral therapy specifically to treat social anxiety disorder.
Thanks. Is there anything else you'd like to add about teens with the disorder or about the disorder in general?
Yeah, I would like to end with saying that shyness itself and social anxiety is really not a bad thing. And in fact, shy people are often very sensitive and very thoughtful and really good at understanding others. And the important thing is to not let your shyness or social anxiety stop you from doing things that you want to do, like meeting people and making friends, dating, speaking in front of groups. And that people who have social anxiety have an underlying belief that they need to be socially perfect. That means no awkward silences, show no signs of anxiety, never trip over their words, never forget people's names. They should always sound smart and interesting. And I call that social perfectionism. And the truth is, no one can meet that standard. So what I tell teens all the time is lower the bar for yourself. Be willing to make mistakes, because everyone else does. And once you develop more realistic expectations for yourself, it becomes a little easier to push yourself to face your fears and really start living the life that you want.
That is just wonderful information and very helpful advice. Thank you. We've been talking with Jennifer Shannon, a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. And this is Jean Kaplan-Tycro for ADAA.